Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Future CEOs here on Cliff Central. My name is Gareth Armstrong. It is good to be with you today. What do we do on Future CEOs? Well, we get the best and brightest into studio to share their journeys and insights and tell us how they do what they do. Why? Because, well, these CEOs, these business pioneers, these entrepreneurs, they're a little bit further along on their journey than us, and they've got wisdom that they probably have collected over a series of mistakes and accidents and failures. Calvo, you're smiling wryly there. That's pretty accurate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Cliff Central Studios. Welcome to the Future CEO Show. It's good to have you here.
Good afternoon, Gareth, and good afternoon to our listeners, and thank you very much for inviting me, and I'm glad to be here.
Calvo, please share with our listeners who you are. So we've brought you here for a reason, but who are you?
I'm Calvo Mawela. I grew up in the rural side of this country, a place called Bushbuck Ridge. And I think the best way to describe me is one journalist wrote an article a few weeks ago after getting appointed as the MultiChoice CEO, and he titled it From Bushbuck Ridge to MultiChoice CEO. So I think that's the best description that anybody has ever put to me.
Well, it's an interesting description, because really what it highlights is this incredible journey that has been your life and your experience. And I'd like to explore that a little bit with you today. Let's start right in the beginning. So, Bushbuck Ridge, born, raised, just describe what circumstances you were under, certainly in the early parts of your life, please.
Yeah. So, Gareth, I grew up in Bushbuck Ridge. I come from a family of seven children, raised by a single mom who used to teach at primary school. And it was a hard upbringing, as many of the black people in the country who come from rural areas will attest to. Mm. And what I found interesting along the journey of growing up in Bushbuck Ridge is that my mother, who happened to be the one that leading the household, just instilled a sense of discipline amongst us. And firstly, that we need to work hard. Secondly, that it doesn't matter what background we come from. We have the brains, and if we've got the will, we should be able to get to whatever that we aspire to be.
You've highlighted something there that is worth just mentioning. This idea of hard work. I read that article, by the way, that you've highlighted, and you highlight hard work as a key part of your journey over and over and over again. Mm. Just a word or two on that value, that thing that is hard work. Where was your first experience of the desire, perhaps, to not work hard, and how did you overcome that? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, so in many instances, I think as a young person, you get to be distracted by what's happening around you. Mm. There is a lot of fun happening around you, and you can easily follow through with other of your peers who are having a lot of fun and not focusing on what's important in life, you know. And I also was part of those that along the way didn't find the best way to have a balance around it. But I think when you get home and you are with your parent, who instills a sense of agency, which instills a sense that you need to live a purposeful life, then you begin to appreciate that you really need to work hard. If your parents also demonstrate that they are prepared to work hard, be that they are just pure teachers and they're putting an effort into making sure that they teach as best as they can, and they get proud when they see some of the people that went through their classes being successful, then that aspire hope in terms of you also getting to work hard. So that is the big element of the discipline that I think my mother brought into me. Yeah,
I like this idea of urgency that you described, because part of the journey that is you is also an education, a university education that was paid for through a loan from what I understand is a loan shark, and that there's no urgency quite like the urgency to pay off a very expensive, some very expensive credit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very grateful for my mom in the way that she handled my way into university, because when I completed my matric and had better symbols that allowed me to go and study engineering, I've always aspired to study engineering. And my mother came to me and said, now that you've completed your matric, what would you like to study? I said, engineering. But little did I have in mind that my mother will be able to even pay for it, because I knew the circumstances didn't allow us to be, didn't allow that she can get, have the money to take me to university.
Mm.
But what she did was she took me by the hand. We walked about a kilometer or so to one of the better houses in the village. And we sat in this lounge, and I could not understand why we are at this house.
Mm.
And my mother then outlined that the son has just completed matric, wants to study electrical engineering at the University of Durban Westville. She has no means for making that happen. Banks will require loans, will look at guarantees for the loans, and she's asking for her to help. Fortunately, the lady sitting on the other side that I learned to know later on as we were leaving the house is that she was loaning people money for whatever means that they need on a day-to-day basis. And that's what we call loan sharks, because the return in terms of the money that you have to pay back of that loan, it's around 30%, which really makes it even worse for a person that is struggling to pay bills on a day-to-day basis.
Very difficult terms, those.
So I'm very grateful that my mother had the courage and gave me that opportunity. And today, I think it's proven to be a very good investment in me, because that's where I am because of that loan that my mother got from the lady that was giving loans in the village.
So I think what we're doing here is we're not advocating taking loans out from loan sharks, but what we're certainly saying is that if there's a bigger vision, if there's a high priority, if there's a sense of urgency, as you've described, then you must do whatever it takes to get the foundation right and solid enough for you to be able to push forward in your life. And that seems to be what you were able to do. There's a certain confidence that comes with it when you get that cap on your head or the gown that you're wearing and you finish your degree and you move out into the world, isn't there?
No. You can't even explain it when you walk out on out of that hall or whatever that you... wherever that you are graduating from, and you see your parents sitting there, and as you leave, you see your parents crying because they could never have imagined coming from a village like Bushbuck Ridge, struggling to make ends meet, just putting bread on the table or food on the table on a day-to-day basis.
Mm.
And there you are, Calvo, graduating with a BSc in electrical engineering.
Mm.
It's the biggest pride that they can ever have. And the way they came to make it happen, it's much more inspirational than you can ever think. And it just encourages more and more people to begin to realize that if your child shows potential, all you can do is give opportunity to people. And if people grab it by their hands, they are able to achieve whatever that is out there.
You know what I love? I love this idea of consciously engaging what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. So often what happens, and you've highlighted, especially in young people, there seems to be a lack of focus. And I'm going to say we, so you and we're also subject to this. But what often seems to happen is that there are going to be distractions that come along. And if we're not intentional or conscious about what we're doing on a day-to-day basis, we can just flow wherever the water's taking us or wherever the wind's taking us. And what taking that a step further, what I really love is this idea of conscious confidence creation. So what I learned quite a few years ago, in fact, it was probably the one pivotal thing that I learned when I was also, so you earned 5,000 rand in your first job. I also earned 5,000 rand in my first job, but I was getting paid in other ways. And one of those ways was through lessons that I was learning. And one of the lessons was a definition for confidence, which is confidence is trust in processes that work. And the only way to engage processes that work or processes in general is very consciously. And so what I'd like us to do for a moment is, or not for a moment, rather the rest of the conversation, is consider your life and how what you've done is accumulate processes that have made you confident. Let's start with your Centec journey where you were earning 5,000 rand there. 5,000 rand is not a lot of money.
Mm.
Why were you doing it? Why did you decide 5,000 rand was good enough to work for this firm?
No, I came from a rural background, never known better how much with an engineering degree I can earn. All I was grateful for is that here is a person again giving me an opportunity to prove myself in a work environment. All I could do is to be grateful for that opportunity and make it work. And it was not the nicest of jobs. I think outside mining, of miners really mining underground, we were among the riskiest jobs that I did because I worked in a department called antenna technology, which means you are more likely on a day-to-day basis, among the things that you'll do is to hang outside the Brixton Tower, which is 300, which is 300 meters high, and fix antenna problems, signal reception problems from there. So
hold on. You're telling me that you were up in 300 meters high fixing antenna?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what I did.
That's a job.
Little did I know whether I'm scared of height or I'm not scared of height.
You just got to
But I just walked in and they said, are you scared of height? I said,
I don't know.
I didn't even say I don't know. I was just glad that there is an opportunity for me to get a job. And it's linked to my electronics engineering that I graduated with. And I took it upon myself that I think let me go in and try to do this job as much as I can.
Mm.
And it will be a learning along the process and let me do it. And as I started doing the job, I realized, okay, everybody hangs out there 300 meters high and people are getting along and it's a nice environment to work in. Then I fit it in nicely and then heights was not a problem. You get used to it over time. It's just a question that you have never been there and then the exposure just helps you. So that's why I started in my career. It was not the nicest of jobs. That's why I'm saying that many people will not take the chance to be hanging outside Brixton Tower. But
that's one heck of a thing. But really, I step back and I look at it and you probably learn that if you can do that, you can probably do anything in the world.
Yeah. So what the learnings are in terms of opportunities that come your way is that all opportunities that come your way, they build you up in terms of character. The character that I'm talking about, that you go into areas that you have never been. If you ask an engineering student at varsity and you tell them that one day you're going to hang out of a 300-meter tower, they will think, no, that's no longer engineering. Mm. It's rigging. Mm. It's people that have never been to school that have to do that particular job. But at that time, I didn't know any better. I said, it's a job. It looks like there are some electronics involved in it, and let me try it. So it builds your character in terms of getting into the world of the unknown, and that's how you begin to appreciate every element of what you do in life, that it all builds you as a person to become what you are today.
When we talk about succession planning, and I've had various conversations over the years with CEOs talking about succession planning, and really what they often do is they reach quite far down into their organization and they look for individuals that show potential. And then intentionally, they move them around the organization to give them a variety of different opportunities and see the business in different ways and from different views, and then also deal with different kind of challenges. And if you're intentional about that, what you've just said is it builds you line upon line. It builds you into this individual that can then be used or is ready for bigger, better opportunities. The Centech thing was an adventure for you. So it certainly sounds like that. What was next? So did you walk the some kind of ladder in Centech within Centech first? What happened?
Yeah. So as an engineer, the immediate task that you have when you get into a work environment is to get professional engineering status, which means you go through an engineering body that evaluates you and checks if you are ready to become a professional engineer, which means you can operate on your own, you can go run your own company, you can do many things independently. And that was the target that I said within Centech. I'm not going to leave 3 years. I have to go in front of the Engineering Council of South Africa and get my professional engineering status. That was the goal. Within 3 years, yes, I was ready with my report, submitted to Engineering Council of South Africa, went through rigorous interviews of checking whether I'm competent enough to be able to operate, and I passed that test and then got my professional engineering status.
Oh, excellent. So it was also within your time frame that you had set. Excellent.
3 years, got it, and I moved on, So that was the nice thing that happened within Centech. Then I became almost a senior engineer because now I've got this engineering professional engineering status cap that I just got. But however, when my career shifted dramatically from that, I went to a meeting somewhere in Cape Town. I met this guy from the Independent Communication Authority of South Africa. We're debating RF engineering and its impact on human bodies because I'm hanging from 300 meters. So I need to be part of that discussion with Department of Health and many other departments. And this guy said to me, there is an opportunity at ICASA for manager of broadcasting spectrum. Will you be interested? At that time, I had little knowledge of ICASA, But the feedback that I was getting from people as I was asking, they said, no, it's not the best place to work, and so forth and so forth. So I went back to him. I said, no, I'm not interested. I think I'm okay where I am. And then he persisted. And then I eventually forwarded my CV. Then the interview date came. I took leave. And then in the morning as I woke up, I said, I think I'm being unfair to the guy. I think I should call him and tell him I'm no longer coming to the interview because I'm really not interested in being in the regulatory environment like ICASA. Lord behold, he calls me before I could call him to tell him I'm not coming. Then he says to me, I think you, I hope you have not forgotten.
You should
come for the interview. It's a very important interview and you need to come through. Then I chickened out. I decided, okay, let me go in and see what ICASA has to offer. I said in the interview, relaxed, because,
There was no pressure at
there
that point.
There was no pressure at that point. I didn't think I'm really interested. Whatever decision they make, it's still fine. I'm happy where I am. And within 2 days, they came back to me and said, no, we've got a job offer for you. And then I started now panicking and telling him, no, man, I don't think that is the place that I want to work. And then it took some convincing, and eventually I gave in. I said, okay, let me go and look out there. I think I'm moving from being a pure technical guy. I'm going to a regulator. It's a management position. So it's a step in the right direction in terms of career. And if I don't like it, I told my manager, I'm going to ICASA, but if I don't like it there,
I'm coming back. Hold the door open.
Keep the door open.
So how long into your journey was this then? So it was 3 years until you got that certificate. Yeah. At this particular point, how long after the certificate?
So I think it should be 4.5 to 5 years at that particular point in time when I joined ICASA.
Total time.
When I joined ICASA. And then I dealt with regulations. Then I'm getting exposed to law. I'm getting exposed to policy. I'm getting exposed to all these other elements, not just the technical side, even though I'm on the technical side.
Yeah, now this is an interesting thing. We sat with the head of Absa Capital once, and he said that when he moves probably vertically up a corporate ladder or sometimes across different businesses, he always hits, always, without doubt, will hit a crisis of confidence. And what that is for him is just he's moved into an environment where he isn't quite able to pull it all together. So there's this on the one hand and that on the other, but he can't connect the dots. Did you experience that? And then how did you deal with it?
Yeah, so I must be frank with you. So little did I know that as soon as I walk in, there was a regulation that has been outstanding that needed to be published. The industry was waiting for it to be commented on. and that's the first job that they wanted me to do. I went in, tried to understand what they were doing, and then very quickly I thought I understood what they were doing. I published it, and it goes out in the government gazette, and we are at the point of contact for that document. It goes through council, of course, for approvals and so forth. And the kind of critique that I found in the industry submitting to me, it was like, Calvo, you know nothing. What are you doing? You felt like you're the most stupid person on earth. But I took it positively and said, okay, they are critiquing the document. If I look at the document, it's consistent with the document that had been published before. I tweaked it a little bit. I thought I'm improving the document that they've done before. But what helped in that whole process is that I didn't take it personal. I took it as a part of the learning process. And then that helped me because then I started looking at the submissions that each company has made over the years, like 3 years back. I used to just go every weekend, go and read their submission and compare. Some of them, fortunately, you start picking up that they are also inconsistent about what they want each year.
They are
contradictions to what they are saying.
Yeah.
Some refer to some regulations of the ITU, for instance, and some have decided to quote what suits them and not quote the whole thing. And when you read the whole thing, it's consistent with what I've done. So I began to realize, okay, no.
You've actually done quite a good job.
No. It's not as bad as I thought I would. And at the hearing, I'll be able to probe all these issues and they will be exposed as to who is actually telling the whole truth. And I will acknowledge my shortcomings. But where they are being inconsistent and being opportunistic, I'll be able to expose those type of things in the discussions.
What's so interesting about feedback and the feedback that you got was, which was quite direct and probably very frank and very open, certainly from when you feel small, that is often the case with that kind of feedback. It tells you where your deficiencies are and where you should be just brushing up. I can feel the ego side of me rejecting some of the feedback that I've received over the years, but it's so interesting that if we open to it, like you said you have been, the kind of remarkable development that happens when you embrace that feedback.
Yeah.
I don't want to break away from your journey, but let's just take a quick aside. Let's look at you as a CEO now, as you sit. Is your team open to feedback? Have you been able to take that same approach to feedback that you have and give it to your team? What has your experience been? Maybe in this role, you're new there, but just over the years, what has your experience been?
No. I feel that the more direct you are in terms of communicating with people, the better. I hardly do wait for PO processes where we evaluate your performance in order to give you feedback. I give people feedback every day. If I think they've done a bad job on something, they get it there and there. No, this is not good enough. Let's redo it. Let's fix it, this and this and that.
How do you keep the emotion out of it, though? Because people get emotional and there's ego involved.
Yeah, some people don't like it, but I think they're better hearing it than not hearing it at all, because then they'll continue giving you giving you the job that they think they are doing good, whereas you know very well that you think that it's not good enough. So some won't like it. They will think many things of you, that you are what and what. But I think it's much better that way. I deal with issues as they happen every day, and there are no qualms. We move from it. We get into something else. And if it does good, I give them a pat at the back and say, well done, this is what I required. And people appreciate that, the honesty that you bring in terms of your leadership, the direction that you give. And then people, it's either they are going to follow you or they are not going to like you, and then they move on to other places. And that's how life works. We don't have to like each other all the time. We don't have to be nice to each other all the time. We have to be direct. We are here to provide a service and deliver excellent service to our customers, and make sure we give the return on our shareholders. That's what we are paid for. If we are not hard on each other and making sure that we deliver that, then we are not doing ourselves any good service.
Yeah, this idea that you always have to be kind and always have to be nice is not quite accurate, I don't think. And I think what has happened is that over time, these people that like to write books and often those who can't do, they teach. And that's a very broad general term. My wife, she loves the academic space, and she always gives me grief when I say that. But often they seem to highlight these ideals, but the practicality of those ideals is very difficult. And I see you shaking your head and nodding now, again, the wry smile, because it really is a difficult thing to be able to implement in a real-world context.
Yeah. I mean, people... So there is this lot of textbook writing about how compassionate you need to be at work, empathy, and so forth and so forth. And they are very important. And I think you need to strike a very good balance where you have to be hard on people that are not performing, be hard on people that are not performing, and be fair to everybody. Where they are doing a good job, give them a pat at the back, encourage them to continue to do the excellent job. And people will understand you, that you are treating them with fairness, and they won't take it personally. So it can't just be compassion for the sake of compassion. We are not there just to
make each other feel good.
Yes. We're not there to make each other feel good. We are there to perform a job, and we need to do our best, make sure that we do the best possible. Then we are able to succeed as companies.
I was speaking to the founder of the Sorbet brand, which is, of course, this very large and was national, now international beauty brand, and the strategy that he employed. And what he's very, very strong on is company culture, but not for company culture's sake, as we're highlighting here, rather because he understands that if you put a certain type of person into the right position, the results come. And I think I'm hearing something similar coming from you here as well.
Yeah. So I've always said, and even in my previous role, that not everybody will succeed in the roles that they play in. Some people will come into a particular role, and you might also have the same impression that these people are going to succeed in this role, and they come in and they let you down.
Mm.
And the sooner you realize that this person is not going to cut it in that particular role, and the sooner you send a message to him that or her that I don't think you're going to cut it in this particular role, and therefore we need to have a different discussion altogether, the better for you, because some of them go on to roles that fit within them and make a good success of it, rather than keeping them there where they are miserable, they can't deliver on what they need to deliver on. Rather have a different discussions with them, and then they can move on to other things.
So this person that kept on hounding you to become part of ICASA, they saw something potentially within you. Did you deliver in the end? Do you feel really good about your time there?
Yeah, I think I've done positive things in terms of what I've done at ICASA, because immediately after leaving, when I was ready to leave ICASA, I had two job offers with two big companies in the country, and I decided to follow the multi-choice one. And through the multi-choice journey, then I'm where I am today. So I think even at ICASA, actually, a person that wanted me to join multi-choice came to me after a number of discussions on a number of regulatory issues and said, the day you decide to leave to ICASA, please come to me and tell me that you'd like me to join another company, and I think we'll always have a place for you because of these elements that we pick up in you.
Okay.
But I dismissed it. I thought, maybe it's just an encouragement from somebody say you're doing a good job, kind words. Yeah. But I dismissed it. But it eventually happened. Yeah.
It actually translated, and I mean, I don't want to go too personal, and I can see you're not the kind of person that's going to be proud and abrasive about what they shared. But what are the qualities that they shared with you that makes them so open?
I think they felt that. I understand. I make sure that I understand the subject matter very, very well.
Yeah, you spoke about studying on weekends and reading. Yes.
Yeah, and it was a new area which required law and everything. I needed to sound like a lawyer, even though I'm an engineer, and quiz them on the law as well as to whether we agree. So I think they found a sense of I get to grasp the subject matter very well and be able to understand what's going on, either in law or the technical side, which is where I was comfortable in. I stuck to my principles in terms of how I perceive the principles that guided that document. And even though they had changed their positions along the way, I kept my principles. Mm. I didn't opportunistically also change my principle. Mm. Even when it suits them, I said, today your principles also apply to me, therefore I'm not going to change because you guys have changed this time around because you wanted to suit you. So those are the elements that I think they sense. In terms of whether I work hard or not, I don't think they will know up until I had joined them. But I think they've seen that I stuck to my principles, and I'm somebody that tries to make sure that I grab the subject matter very well and present it to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah, internal steel, that ability to stay the path no matter what comes your way, is a rare thing, and it's enhanced by these other elements, which is a really good work ethic. But this idea of steel inside of you, which is really a values-driven thing, there's an integrity to it, which, and I'm not talking about the honesty debate, I'm talking about an integrity, the ability to stick to your word no matter what, whatever your word is. It seems like you do have that.
Yeah, no. I'm a person that sticks to whatever I communicate to you. I don't make promises that I can't fulfill. And in all my engagements with people, I'm being honest with them. If something cannot be done, I tell you in your face, it can't be done. It's not going to happen, that one. I don't care how you're going to take it, but at least I've delivered the message to you. So that I think it's a principle that we all need to live by. Let's not make false promises. Let's not mislead people into thinking something else, whereas you know what you're thinking. And as a leader, I think when you stick by those principles, then it becomes an easier conversation to have with people, because that's what they want to get from you, that you hold them accountable, you are fair, you are principled, and you don't mislead them in any way.
Mm. If we go back to the definition of confidence, which was shared earlier, confidence is trusting in processes that work. The implication behind trust itself is that there's a consistency, and so people can definitely trust you. And what often happens is people don't always trust you initially, but then they'll trust your background, the processes that you have. But anyway, consistency and trust, those are two things that I'm hearing come out here in this conversation quite strongly. I'd like to move the conversation a little bit, because I'm fascinated by the challenge that you have ahead of you, which is very interesting. In a more and more digital environment, an on-demand environment, the world that you've inherited, certainly historically anyway, is changing, and is changing dramatically. They've turned to you. They're looking to you to lead multi-choice into the new world, or further along into the new world. Tell me about your thoughts there. Yeah. That must have crossed your mind as you were making the decision.
Yeah. So it crossed my mind, and I think I've been 12 years in the company, so I've been around the company for too long. But when you look at the company and how it has transitioned over the years, it was the first company to launch pay TV, DTH, outside direct to home, outside of the US, and successfully so. We are where we are today, where we are facing online competition that is coming our way. However, this company has shown that its DNA is to thrive through technological changes and continue to lead as technology evolves over time. So that gives me a sense of comfort that the DNA within the multi-choice people is that we embrace change, we adapt to new technologies, and we have been successful in technology disruptions that have faced this business before. And when I look at the team composition at executive level, it gives me comfort. We are not stuck onto the DTH and focusing just on the old. We are looking ahead. We are saying, this is the opportunity that comes our way, guys. We need to embrace it. We need to take it within our stride to make sure that we succeed. And those comes with a lot of elements that we need to do it. And as I lead this organization, then I bring in the element that says, yes, we need to put everything that we do at the center of it should be that we are moving digital, we are moving online, and that's where the future is going to be. It's going to disrupt our business model. It might mean that the whole business model has to collapse in order for us to be able to have a business in the future.
And we'll call that rise the rise of a phoenix, right?
Yes.
I think that's a good analogy.
That's a good analogy, Gareth. And yeah, so that is the essence of it. And you need to bring in case studies as well for people to begin to appreciate that there are businesses that have allowed disruption in terms of technology or whatever to eat into their lunch and ultimately disappear. Big businesses that today no longer exist because as technology came in, they remained complacent and thought, no, it's going to come in 10 years. It's not going to come now. Little did they know, within 3-5 years, their business is gone. They no longer have a business to show for it. So with us, we are proactively investing in online, like Showmax, DStv Now, and all many other products, and focusing a lot of energy into that. They are not going to make money today, but we know in the future, that's where we're going to get our money from.
Yeah, if you look at things with the correct time horizons, through the correct lenses, and you act in the most appropriate way now for then, you're moving in the right direction. I'm fascinated by this idea that people are instant. And so the customers that you're speaking to, they want instant things right now. But businesses don't really work like that, especially larger businesses. There are time horizons. There's a strategy that's unfolding. How do you deal with individuals who potentially are in your business with you that have an expectation of too much, the wheel is taking too long to turn? How do you pull them into seeing it for what it is right now?
Yeah, so there are a lot of things that you need to communicate with people. I think communication is the most important thing in the business. Leave no doubt in their mind that, yes, this is where the business is going. There's no doubt about it. People then have the comfort. They know where they are going in terms of where the business is going. The second element, which I agree with what you have raised, is that Agency needs to come to the center of everything that we are doing. We can't keep on talking about things and people not seeing anything changing within the business. So we need to push people to get things done much quicker. And as soon as they can feel these things that are happening, then they begin to appreciate that indeed we are moving in that direction. So I tend to agree with people that have impatience in terms of seeing results. And I would like us to push as much as possible to get to those points that we need to get to. So I don't find it that we need to hold back and look at the 3-year horizon, 5-year, 10-year horizon. We need to act now and get things in place now. And then all that we can be fighting for is how well we are received by the consumers out there as to whether we are reaching the targets that we are reaching, or we are not getting the targets to the targets that we set for ourselves. And then we need to change the model for it to be able to get to the customers that we really want.
So you've described one of the pillars of your leadership, which is communication, potentially even over-communication. I can hear it already. What are your other two pillars of this trifecta that make up the makeup of your leadership?
Yeah, so you drive communication, you drive performance within teams. And you know, you send a message that you are not going to tolerate mediocrity within the organization. If that is the mantra of what you are communicating, be consistent, keep rehashing it in every forum that you can get. And those three pillars that you have made it your mantra, let them see it happening. That you are not tolerating mediocrity, which means there's consequences for mediocrity. Those that do well, which means there is reward for people that do well within the business. And that's the best way that you can be able to get everybody focused on a particular goal.
I think you've half answered the question already, but here's the challenge to that is, how do you do it without coming across like a dictator?
Yeah. So it's a very difficult thing to do, because ultimately, as a leader, you have to make the decisions. You have to make those unpopular decisions along the way. And it's your responsibility to do that. And the board and the shareholders have given you the responsibility to act like that. So you'll have to engage with people, get the buy-in of everybody within the organization, but not buy-in for the sake of buy-in where you think you're going to lead by consensus all the time. You are the ultimate person that's going to make the decision. You can engage, but ultimately make the decision. And that message needs to come across very, very strongly, that you are going to make the decision. And avoid being indecisive. Do not be an indecisive leader. Rather make wrong decisions and fix it later, because you realize that it's wrong, and don't make a decision at all.
It was the head of, I forget the business, but he said to me, if you make decisions and 50% of them are wrong, that's better odds than you're going to get at any casino, so make decisions. But to your point, exactly, rather make decisions and be wrong and then adjust along the way than just get stuck and not do anything.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic, fantastic point. I'm looking at the clock and we begin to wind down the conversation. It's been fascinating so far, and I'm hearing some of the questions that our listeners are asking. Let me ask you some of them. So you've described your leadership philosophy. Let's just talk a little bit about what has happened over time when you've engaged with mentors. And so you would have received advice from individuals you look up to and others. What's the worst advice you've ever received?
No, I will not say the worst advice per se, but what I found is that some mentors want to shape you into what you are not.
Okay.
Which means that they will want to bring elements that it's not within you, you know, and try to make you follow those elements within your leadership. I think mentors need to look at you and see you for what you are, and then bring nice elements into it for you to get to the next level.
To enhance the natural instincts that you have,
exactly.
Rather than try and make you a jack of all trades but a master of none.
Exactly. So okay. you may try to make Calvo to be a guy that has got some fun elements into that. That's not me. I'm a serious guy. I focus on what needs to be done every day, and I want to get home making when I get home, I want to have peace that I've done the best that I could, and that's how I am. I'm not going to stand in front of 1,000 people and make jokes. That's not me. That's not how I bring people closer to me.
You give me great peace by saying that, because I'm just a natural introvert, and I like to be introverted, but the world seems to be attracted to these extrovert types.
Yeah.
But you're smiling, and we're having a good conversation here. So that's not necessary for this kind of interaction. So don't let your mentor mold you into something that you're not.
Yeah.
I guess the challenge there is sometimes you don't know what you can be, and so maybe your mentor is pushing you in a particular direction. How do you identify that?
So that is one element that I've seen. Mm. And if it doesn't work, you make it clear to that person that that's not me.
It just really isn't working.
It's not me.
I think I hear you say, give it a go. But if it's really unnatural and it really doesn't work, then you must push it away.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. Oh, that's a good way to solve that problem.
Yeah.
Mm. Then let's move to the best advice that you've ever received and acted on.
Mm. So the best advice that I've ever received, Gareth, is along the lines that when you put the best effort forward in everything that you do on a day-to-day basis, you are more likely to reach the results that you are looking for. Mm. It doesn't matter what you do.
So best effort.
Yeah, put the best effort in everything that you do. That will show in the results at the end of the day. And that's the mantra that I try to live by, that in every little thing that I do, it's either I'm writing a paragraph or I'm writing a letter responding to a particular letter. Mm. Let me write it as best as I can.
Give yourself to that moment, I think.
Yes, fix it, get it right, and then send it. And it must come across as the best effort that we have put in. Mm. In many instances, that plays itself in many other things that you need to perform. And that plays itself in terms of your performance in life. So that is a key aspect that I try to practice every day, that as I walk into the office, every little thing that comes to me, I apply the best of my mind. And if I have to critique it, I critique to the best of my abilities and make sure that I give the best feedback that I can give. In that way, then it plays itself out in terms of performance wherever I'm driving performance.
Yeah, it's the time horizon thing. It's putting the horse before the cart. It's saying, in order to get there, I really need to do this now, and I need to do it really well. That's sound advice. Thank you for sharing. I guess on that though, so there's going to be times where you have put your best effort in, but then you're met with disappointment. How do you deal with disappointment when it comes across your desk or in your life in some whatever form it comes?
Yeah, so I like winning. To be honest with you, I've been a competitive child at an early age. I wanted to be number one in class all the time. Back in the days when we used to be rated by number one, number two, number three.
Oh, yes.
So I always strive to be number one. Not that I've become number one all the time. There are times that I was back, I was not the best performing student. So that is what I try to do at all costs. However, I think through experience and life going on, I began to appreciate that I can do as much to the best that I can. Mm-hmm. And if I don't get the result that I'm looking for, I need to go back and look at what has gone wrong and use that as a learning for the next thing that is coming my way in life.
How do you not beat yourself up about it though? So I can hear our listeners are saying that's really a good way to approach it, re-look and rehash and try and fix it up for the next time. But during that period, I look at myself and I judge myself very harshly. I'm my own worst critic, as they might say. How do you deal with the emotional side of it?
No. So when you are leading, you don't have the luxury to bring emotions into all those things that you are doing. You need to hold it back somewhere else in a corner, because it might be that the whole team has failed to deliver on a specific goals. Mm. And therefore, if the leader is throwing his hands up in the air and saying, guys, we are really losing this battle, then the whole business might collapse. So you hold it back, you go and cry somewhere else. When you come in, you need to inspire people, keep people motivated and look forward to the next challenge. That is not the end of the world. And that's what leaders have to bring into teams. Mm. And that's what I try to bring into teams and push and remind them of the things that we have done in the past, that this might just be a dent, but we know we are capable enough. We should be able to achieve better results next time, and let's forge ahead.
I like that a lot. Go and beat a punching bag. Do whatever you need to do to release it, but do it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Don't do it in front of your team. Make sure that you're a pillar of sorts for them.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. What are you reading at the moment? What book are you reading?
So at the moment, because I'm just so focused on this, on the business and making sure that we perform and we are facing very big giants in terms of performance and so forth, in terms of the competition that is coming to the market, the likes of Facebook and everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
What I found, I went back to reading books that I've read in the past. Mm. And the book that I'm reading at the moment is by Jack Welch called Winning.
Winning,
yeah. Okay. So if you remember, Jack Welch is one of the phenomenal guys, guy that took GE from here to the next stage.
Mm.
And it was one of the big companies, then went down, and then he picked it up again.
Yep.
So I found his writing to be very simplistic, to be very direct. And I think I relate to how he values feedback, what form of motivations you need to bring into your workforce, and how you communicate, honest, frank, robust, and that plays itself in terms of people performing. And if you reward people that perform and deal with those that don't perform, then the business is on a better trajectory. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to instill is a sense that say that we are competing with the best in the world, mm-hmm. and therefore we need to be the best in the world as well. Otherwise, if we are not going to be the best in the world, they are going to eat us for lunch.
It's amazing. 10 years ago, would you have thought that you would have been competing against the best in the world? Because that's the world we live in. We are not, we're in a global world. You're in a global environment. Mm. What people are consuming, they're consuming from all around the world. You have to compete against them. Yeah. What a thought.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's round off the conversation. And we with one or two more questions. And I think what we'll do is we'll jump to the most important question I think we always ask all of those that come through that door and sit behind that mic. And that is the question: if you could go back in time and talk to yourself, to the young 20-year-old future CEO you, what would you say to yourself?
I think I will have been more inclined to say there could have been opportunities that I would have taken up and added on to the things that I needed to do in terms of expanding my knowledge. And that included a number of things. Learning business acumen from an early age. Not just focusing on my engineering degree, and whenever I get spare time, then I have fun or play sport and whatever. It's important to have that element also into it. But I think I could have expanded my knowledge at a much earlier age.
But as a complement, right? Not as an only focus.
No. So as a complement, you don't have to stop having fun. You don't have to stop playing sport, and all those elements help me to build what I am. But I think I could have expanded a little bit more.
Mm.
The business acumen, I could have read a lot around business and how it operates. I could have learned finances a little bit more at a much earlier age.
Mm.
And I think that those elements would have been very fruitful today.
Mm. Yeah, the language of finance, what a language to be able to try and grasp later on in your life. It's better to start early. Calver, it's been a fantastic conversation, a fascinating conversation. Thank you for being here on the Future CEO Show to share some of your journey. And what we're going to do is we're going to be sitting behind the scenes, watching very carefully, and we wish you all the best in this new journey that is the CEO of MultiChoice. What a phenomenal opportunity, and we're excited for you. We're nervous for you as well, because it's one heck of an undertaking in an ever-changing, rapidly changing world.
Mm.
Thank you for being here to share some of your journey with us, and we hope to catch up with you real soon.
Thank you, Gareth. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you to your listeners.
All right, that's all we have time for this week. We are going to be back again next week with top CEOs, with executives and entrepreneurs that are pushing their businesses as fast and hard as they can. If you want to learn from them, make sure you tune into Future CEOs. Download our podcast at cliffcentral.com, or alternatively go to future-ceos.com to get the podcasts there. We'll see you again soon.
Cliff Central. The revolution. I've got something important to tell you. CliffCentral.com.